So, yeah, so I want to begin with a reading from Saraha. It says that within my body are all the sacred places of the world. This is kind of similar to that beautiful teaching from the Buddha, that within this fathom-long body with its thoughts and emotions lies our world. Its origin, its cessation, its pathway to freedom is within this fathom-long body. And Saraha says that within my body are all the sacred places of the world and the most profound pilgrimage I can ever make is within my own body. The most profound pilgrimage I can ever make is within my own body. And I just want to welcome you to this pilgrimage. It's quite amazing to be alive. Very mysterious. So today I want to speak. I was reflecting on what I wanted to offer, and I think what is feeling most alive in me is various jewels and teachings of the Dharma that just I'm so immensely grateful for. And I'll say right away that I'm not going to be able to say all of them in this one talk. I might name it, perhaps, or not, but these are things that are very important to me, like jewels. But I think I want to first, one of the jewels is speaking about the story of the Buddha, the myth of the Buddha's awakening. And it actually has a timeless past, where there's been actually, according to the Buddhist cosmology, many other Buddhas. But the one perhaps that we know of is Siddhartha Gautama. But the story of Siddhartha's journey began a long time ago in a faraway galaxy. And sometimes in the Buddhist mythology, they speak about eons as times of measurement. And to give you an idea of how long an eon is, in the Dharma teachings, it says an eon is once every 100 years, a bird flies over the tallest mountain in the world and brushes its wing against that mountain peak. And the length of an eon is that it will gradually, through those once every 100 years, with that brush of the wing, it will ground that mountain down into a plain. So this is a long time ago in a faraway galaxy. A long time ago, there was another Buddha. And that Buddha's name was Dipankara. And Dipankara was walking on an alms round, and it had rained the day before, the night before, and as Dipankara was walking, this person named Sumedho saw that there was a really big puddle right on the path of the Buddha. And Sumedho thought to himself, I don't want to get the Buddha's feet wet, and I'm going to lie down in this water so the Buddha can walk on top of me. Which he did. And as the Buddha was walking on top of him, Sumedho had this wish, I want to become a Buddha, just like Dipankara. And after the Buddha walked over him, he turned back to Sumedho and said, you will become a Buddha, and your name will be Siddhartha Gautama. And that began this journey of what's known as the Bodhisattva, the cultivation of paramis, of perfections to be developed in the Buddhist cosmology from lifetime to lifetime, sometimes being born as a human, sometimes as an animal, sometimes as a celestial being, cultivating these qualities of generosity, virtue, renunciation, wisdom, energy, patience, truthfulness, resolution, loving kindness, equanimity. These are called the 10 perfections. And it's actually very wonderful for those of you that are a little geeky in the canonical literature. You can look up the Jataka tales, wonderful tales of 547 different lifetimes of the Bodhisattva, sometimes as a lion, sometimes as a bird, sometimes as a human being, and these different stories of the different lives of the Bodhisattva developing these perfections, these qualities, these beautiful qualities to support awakening as a Buddha. And so it came to pass that, so there was a baby born 2,600 years ago named Siddhartha, and was born into a family where the father was a king, mother was a queen, but she actually passed on at childbirth. And so Siddhartha was brought up with his king and also the sister's, his mother's sister, who actually later was the founder of the Woman's Bhikkhuni Order. But at that time, Siddhartha was grown up with a lot of loving care. And it was very common in those days in northern India that when a child is born, a baby is born, that sometimes they will bring in some holy people to, you know, there's kind of this tradition looking at the length of the ears and its other anatomical features, the disposition, and they would make predictions. And there was five of these people that came. And four of them said, he will become a great, great king. The father was incredibly pleased. But one of them, the youngest one, said, no, he will become a Buddha. And the king got very upset hearing this. And even though four of them said, no, he's going to become a great king, somehow the king was concerned and did not want his son to become a Buddha and decided to, yes, to have him live a very sheltered life, a life of pleasure and sports and entertainment and build palaces for each of the season. And, you know, for the first 29 years, Siddhartha was having, as you know, Mary Grace referred, like, how many wives did Siddhartha have? And, you know, there was a lot of pleasures and entertainment and sports and whatever to be had. So the story goes. And in his 29th year, something awakened in Siddhartha, and he realized he hadn't been much out into the kingdom, and he was curious how the people live. And so he went with a charioteersman named Jana, and they went out to the kingdom and just walking around, looking at different things. And then they came across, and Siddhartha saw this, like, kind of a very old person, no hair on their head and gray hair where it was left and kind of bent over a bit and walking slowly. And somehow in that moment, Siddhartha's eyes opened. Like, who is this? He asked Jana. And Jana said, this is an old person. If you live long enough, no one can escape from aging. It's powerful. And in that moment, Siddhartha got it. It was like a piercing. I'm actually later this month, I turned 69. And I remember when I turned 50, the 49th year was more difficult than the 50th because, like, oh my gosh, I'm going to be 50. And I'm finding already, you know, in a few days I'm going to be 69. It's like, oh yeah, what? Then the year after that I'm going to be 70. And it's kind of powerful to, wow, 70. Where did it go? My teacher, Langdit Sero, on his 80th birthday, the Burmese forest monk, and I asked the Sero, he was a person of few words. but great teacher. I asked him, how you're 80, like how fast has that gone? And he looked at me and smiled and he answered this way, 80 years, just like that, 80 years. Yeah. And of course, there's no guarantee I'll even live to my birthday to turn 69. I also know that. But it's powerful. For whatever arises has its beginning and middle and ending. In early life, you think, you got a whole life to live. But then all of a sudden, you've lived a whole life to live. And there's much less than there was that's already been lived. It's so interesting to embrace. So in that moment, Siddhartha awakened to this truth of aging. And he went back, from the kingdom. And actually, it says that in actually pretty quick time, he was back to his pleasure palaces and so forth and whatever, doing what he was doing. And then there's this other, all of a sudden he thought again, I want to go out into the kingdom. So he went out with Chana again. And this time he came across, another messenger happened. He, no doubt, seeing how people live in the marketplace and so forth, but then he came across someone that was clearly very, very ill. And he asked Chana, who is this? And Chana said, this is a person that is ill and that no one can escape from illness. And this was like another piercing. And, in my mind, it's perhaps Siddhartha has seen people ill before and maybe people ill before, but somehow living in this dream world, it didn't quite penetrate till that moment. No one can escape from illness. Yesterday, it's not so easy to get doctors and doctor's appointments. This was set many months ago, and I had a doctor's appointment yesterday at 2:00. And I was out in the parking lot parking my car, and I got a call, and I recognized it was a very close friend of mine who I've taught many, many retreats with him for many years. And he says, hey, Bob, it's Steve. I got Alzheimer's. I was like, whoa, I got Alzheimer's. He's 73 years old. It really paused me in my tracks. Not like, oh, okay, see you later. I got to go. I got Alzheimer's. I got this. I got that. It can take your breath away. And I know a number of you here have already been living with illnesses or working with people with illnesses. No one can escape from illness. In Siddhartha, it was a piercing. It's truth. And it said that he went back to the palace and again, his heart was stirred a bit, but, there's a lot of good things happening there and, was swept away again and the story goes after a period of time. Again, this urge, this something calling. I want to go back out to the kingdom another time and called Chana and they went out this time and again seeing how people live and all the different things. But this time another messenger came. He saw. Well, he didn't know what he saw, but there was a person lying on the ground and they weren't breathing and they were a little bit discolored. And then he put his hand to touch this person's arm, and it was cold. He says to Chana, who is this? Chana says, this is a person who has died. No one can escape from aging, from death. No one can escape from death. And this was a big piercing into Siddhartha. Just right before this retreat, just a few days before, my beloved brother-in-law passed away at the age of 63, Michael. Jane Kenyon writes, I got out of bed on two strong legs. It might have been otherwise. I ate cereal, sweet milk, and a ripe, flawless peach. It might have been otherwise. I took the dog uphill to the birchwood, and all morning I did the work that I love, and at noon I lied down with my mate. It might have been otherwise. We ate dinner together at a table with silver candlesticks. It might have been otherwise. I slept in a bed in a room with paintings on the walls, and I planned another day just like this day. But one day, I know it will be otherwise. One day, I know it will be otherwise. This piercing of this truth. Very early in my own life, I had this understanding that one day it'll be otherwise. I was 4 years old, riding in the back seat of my parents' car, and there was just this unmistakable realization, this understanding about life that I was going to die, everybody was going to die, and it could happen at any time. Now, how many of you remember the first moment you realized you were going to die? Does anybody remember? So some of you with your hands up, some of you, maybe you're hearing it for the first time. Sorry, you're going to die. My wife says, don't call these mindfulness retreats. Call them you're going to die retreats. But it's very powerful when you realize it's not going to last. This was a huge piercing into Siddhartha's heart, if you will. And even coming back to the palace, he wasn't interested in these pleasure things now, entertainment, sports. He was really cooking with these truths of aging and illness and death and what is this life? So after a period of time, he was somehow called out into the kingdom. And again, he went out with Chana. And this time, he came across somebody walking. And he had never seen a person like this. This person seemed to be very composed, serene, mindful, if you will. Like the way that they walked was so just something there, ardent, heedful, present. Siddhartha asked Chana, who is this? And Chana said, this is a sadhu. This is a person that is dedicating to their life to understand the meaning of life. And when Siddhartha heard that, there was like a glimmer of hope. You mean there's actually people that do this? Chana says, yeah, there's a tradition. Sadhus, holy people, ascetics, wanderers, hermits, mendicants. And so Siddhartha came back to the palace and was just reflecting on these, and then he began to realize that this is the only thing that made sense to him. To dedicate his life to understanding the meaning of life. He was married. They were expecting a child. But his heart was so pierced. There's actually Pali language is one particular word that describes a state of consciousness. It's called samvega, or thamvega. And what it means is that when you realize that death can come at any moment, it catapults you into a sense of spiritual urgency. What is this life? And so he had this type of samvega-type consciousness, this urgency. What is this life? And so he decided He wanted to leave and devote his life to understanding the meaning of life, to become a sadhu. He knew that his wife and child-to-be and family would of course be well taken care of with the kingdom, the king, and so forth. And I always like to say that it's wonderful that after Siddhartha awakened, became a Buddha, he came back. I always like to say, yep, the Buddha was a family man. He came back to his wife, to his child, to his family, and shared with them what he had learned. They too awakened greater wisdom and compassion. But it's a powerful sojourn. Siddhartha leaving the palace, shaving his head, getting rid of his princely garments and putting on rag robes and beginning to study with different teachers. And he was a quick student and was very prevalent in those days and times that the main meditation practices were development of jhanas or absorptions, development of concentration in profound degrees. And Siddhartha, being a very masterful student, often his teacher would say, all right, you've learned everything that I know, and come and sit with me, and we can teach other students. And the results of doing these types of jhanic absorption practices is you're very concentrated, you become at one with the object you're bringing attention to, there's unification, there's one-pointedness, there's just vast degrees of absorption of consciousness, nothing, perception, non-perception, and so forth, emptiness. But even though this Siddhartha was a master of these types of absorptions, it could calm his mind to a profound degree of one-pointedness and unification, he felt it wasn't enough. It could calm his mind, but didn't, this human condition still was not understood. Mary Grace mentioned yesterday about then he started practicing self-mortification with the reduction of food and coming to a place where he became skeletal. He was going to die. And then deciding to leave this self-mortification practice, taking a more middle path and meeting this wonderful woman named Sujata with her care, with her kindness, supported and nourished his health. From this time, leaving Sujata, feeling well nourished again, he came across a tree overlooking some beautiful area, and he took his seat underneath the tree and made a deep resolve inside him. He'd been to so many different teachers and practiced so many different teachings, and that I'm going to just stay here. There's no other place to go. I'm going to see for myself with my own experience this internal deep resolve. I love this story. And within this story, there's something here that's just so remarkable that I'll share. That as he took his seat and began to practice, a memory arose in him when he was a young boy, sitting underneath another tree, overlooking a very beautiful area as well. And so there's a story of him reminiscing when he was a child and feeling this. If you had those moments where you just feel like one with the world, it's just a beautiful moment. If everything feels connected. So he's just reminiscing the sense of feeling that oneness of the world, feeling connected. He hadn't remembered this for so many years, and it was all coming back to him now, this memory. And then another part of the memory arose within him that he'd completely forgotten. Then he looked over, and there was a pasture, and there was some farmers and oxen and a plow, and they were getting ready to begin to turn the soil over for, you know, planting and so forth. And as the plow blade went into the earth, maybe because Siddhartha's sensitivity was so heightened, feeling that oneness of the world, when the plow blade entered into the earth, he could almost sense and hear the cries of the worms. And this feeling arose with him of such heartbreak. And it's such a juxtaposition of feeling this oneness and beauty and connection with the world and the heartbreak of the world. I love this so much, this teaching. I can relate to it. Thich Nhat Hanh says, my joy expands to the far reaches of the universe and my tears fill every ocean of the world. It's like both there. And so it's said that perhaps because he was so moved with this remembering, that when he began to become mindful of the breath, no doubt he was developing his concentration. He was a master of concentration. But instead of going into deep, profound absorption, he directed his concentrated mind to beginning to be aware of the changing nature of the breath. This was a historic moment. Because again, what was understood in meditation was absorption, calmness, tranquility, one-pointedness, unification. And he shifted to the arise and the fall. That's why we see in the Satipatthana Sutta, the four foundations of mindfulness, is multiple refrains and references to the origination, the dissolution, the coming, the going, the beginning, the ending, the mark of impermanence. It's the hallmark, if you will, the core of insight meditation, beginning to penetrate the sense of impermanence, non-self, dukkha, dissatisfactoriness, but through this nature of change, something happened to Siddhartha. There was some awakening that began to arise within him. Perhaps it's that sense of that heartbreak of the worms, feeling the sensitivity, also those messengers of aging, illness, and death. And it became very clear to Siddhartha, right there and then, there's a truth to suffering. It cannot be denied. It was a realization, really. It was a realization of the truth of suffering. And it's very humbling, very sobering. Yeah, when I heard my friend, Bob, I have Alzheimer's. Oh, my heart. Oh. He was actually holding it quite well. He's a longtime practitioner. This is what it is, Bob. He was dealing with it better than I was at that moment. He's my teacher. But what arose in Siddhartha is now beginning to become an awakening Buddha, awakening and realizing this powerful truth of suffering. It doesn't negate the wonderful joys that we have in this world, but it was a sobering, deep understanding of this truth. From that awakening, he was curious. This is practice, factors of awakening begin to grow, mindfulness, investigation, and energy, and the joy of really getting into it and so forth, factors opening. And it became like, what is this cause? It's a good question. This suffering, what's its source? He sat with that, open to it, felt it, experienced it. And like something came into him of a knowing, an understanding. And that the understanding was that the most profound and deepest cause is unawareness, ignorance, not seeing clearly into the nature of things, misconception. A of the beloved teacher Tampulu Sero of mine used to say in a poetic way that the midnight is dark. When the new moon is out, it's dark. When you're in the deep forest, it's dark. But he said, darkest of all is ignorance. Darkest of all is ignorance, because it's with ignorance that promotes the cycle. He used to say, if you know, you can break the cycle, but if you don't know, you go around and around, that this is dependent origination. But this ignorance sets up some sort of misconception, perhaps some belief that happiness can be found through some different areas. And I want to just acknowledge that we as human beings, like to be happy, like to get happiness. I think the question is, where is it to be found, this happiness? It's very interesting, a play of words here too, that's kind of fun. Often in our mythology as human beings, you know, in the West, it was like the land of utopia, finding utopia. In the East, Shangri-La, and there's different traditions that speak about this place of paradise. You can finally be at rest. Well, it's very interesting. In utopia has its root in Greek, and what it literally means is nowhere. But we're striving, hungering, thirsting, pining to get to utopia, but it's nowhere. But actually, within the word nowhere, we can play with the letters a little bit. It also can spell now, here. Oh, so maybe there's a little map. So again, maybe who looks outside dreams and who looks inside awakens, looking inside. But I want to just honor that for as human beings, we're wired with our five senses and our mind to go more towards feeling good and less towards feeling bad. And of course, there's a lot of good things that we can do that feel really good. And so, you know, we may want to get more of that. This misunderstanding kind of tricks us with the belief that perhaps we can get more and more. But they're just things. But this is perhaps some of the root of addiction. So we want more. And perhaps because it feels so good, we can lose ourselves. I have a friend of mine who's a Dharma practitioner and teacher. In her younger life, she had some challenges in life, and there was a period of time that she was a heroin addict. And one time we were talking about this, and I've done my share of things, but I haven't done heroin. And I was curious to ask her, what does heroin feel like? I was really curious because I hadn't tried it. And I don't think I plan to either, to be honest. But what she told me was, Bob, it was the best feeling I ever had in my entire life. And all I knew was I wanted to do it again and again and again. So I kept on injecting again and again and again. But it wouldn't stay. It wouldn't stay. That's why in Buddhist psychology, when we look at this type of addictive craving, it's not considered morally wrong, but we could consider it as a cause of suffering. And why is that? Because this desire, this craving, this addiction keeps you wanting and wanting what you can't have because it doesn't last. So the Buddha was beginning to awaken to this truth of, oh, this primary cause is misconception, misunderstanding, unawareness, ignorance, so forth. And also the understanding that there's no fire hotter than greed when we're really on it. And no ice colder than hatred. And no fog thicker than unawareness or ignorance. But again, due to this misconception, this belief that perhaps I can find happiness outside, it causes us to go into things again and again. There's a beautiful rendering of the cause of suffering by actually Mary Grace's monk friend, Achen Amaro. I just love this particular rendering. And he says, this is the noble truth of the cause of suffering. It is craving, a craving that is compelling and intoxicating. Anybody experienced that ever? A craving that is compelling and intoxicating, like a piece of dark chocolate or whatever it be. Yeah. A craving that is compelling and intoxicating and causing us to be born into things again and again, ever seeking delight now here and now there. Namely, it's the craving for sensual delight, the craving to be something or someone, and the craving to feel nothing. Very powerful. So I'd like to just unpack these a little bit, this craving for sensual delight. And, you know, we are wired to feel good. So this is like the eros, the libidinal, it's gratification, it's pleasure. And we can get very caught in it. I can get very caught in it. I've actually made it my study the last number of years to investigate where is it that I go when I'm lost in my sense pleasures, whatever it is. And what I can come up with is that where I go is where there is no I. There's just pleasure and just wanting to live in that pleasure and stay there forever. But of course, it doesn't stay there forever. It's really interesting to watch and experience your craving as a practice and even getting what it is that you're desiring and stay with it. Where do you go? What happens? Remember one time, and I've shared this before, some of you have heard this, I was eating my favorite vegan ice cream, and it was just heaven. It just lost in the pleasure of the ice cream. It's wonderful just losing oneself into pleasure, I'll admit it. But then I saw in that bowl, there was only a couple of spoonfuls left. And then there was like a different feeling tone moved in. An unpleasant one. And I began to think, what am I going to do? There's only one or two more bites left. And then I thought, oh, there's more in the freezer. I'll go put some more in. I didn't do that. But I could see how quick it is. But what is it that I want to go back in that freezer and do more? Because I love losing myself into pleasure so I don't have to feel the pain of this life in some way. It's interesting to hang with that. This longing. Longing perhaps to lose myself into something, which is actually connected to the craving to feel nothing, just so I don't have to be here. I don't have to be here. I don't have to feel anything. So these are interconnected. And, you know, we see even sometimes in political figures that no matter how many people are in the audience, it's never enough. Or you make up numbers that they're more than who they are, like this powerful craving for satisfaction, for pleasure, again, interlaced with to be someone. So I kind of, as I go into rock music, maybe the Rolling Stones really did have some deep insight. Like, I just can't get no satisfaction no matter how much I try and I try and I try. I just can't get no. This craving for sensual delight. It's big. It's powerful. It's strong. Kabir writes, 1,000 years ago, he says, "Friend, please tell me what I can do about this world that I hold on to, and it keeps on spinning out. I gave up my sewn clothes, and now I wear a robe. But then I noticed one day that the cloth was well woven, so I bought some burlap. but I still throw it elegantly over my left shoulder. I pull back my sexual longings, and now I discover I'm angry a lot. I gave up rage, and now I notice I'm greedy all day. I worked hard at dissolving the greed, and now I'm proud of myself. This goes on forever. There's no end. It's the craving to be something, to be someone, narcissism, egocentricity, I. And it has its both spectrums, inflation, deflation. Remember once in a meditation retreat some years ago, I happened to see a yogi walking outside meditating, and something about the way that he was walking, lifting, moving, placing, there's a certain type of elegance. I don't know. Sometimes if you look in the ocean like those old clipper ships with the big sails and how it's just majestically just going along, and somehow this person doing this walking meditation, I just look like it was just beautiful to see him walk. And at the end of the retreat, he was sharing, some of us, that there's a point during the middle of the retreat, as he looked around doing his walking meditation, a thought entered into his mind, thinking, I am the best walking meditator in the whole retreat. Oh, inflation, how can I? And then as soon as he realized that he had thought that, then it was like deflation. I'm the worst meditator. Like, I can't believe that I even thought such a thing. So it has this inflation and deflation connected to sense of self. This is because deep down there's a powerful insecurity. I have to look outside for my worth, for my approval. I need your validation. I've shared this before, so I know some of you heard this, but it was just a funny little learning that, maybe 10, 15 years ago, I put something on Facebook, a poem or whatever, and then I happened to notice this was kind of, I was kind of new to it, and I saw there was some people checked off like, and like, oh, that's kind of nice, and at one point I looked again, there was 199 likes, and then I thought to myself, you know, it'd be nice to get 200. Like, what the, is 200 really going to do it? No. Then I want 201. 200's not enough. Yes, I've said this in a... So someone then... I saw on the yogi board, someone wrote me a note. He gave me an infinite like card. You think that would satisfy me? No, I wanted two. So then somebody said, here's an infinite like, two of the infinite like cards. And as that wasn't enough, then someone wrote another one. Well, here's a forever like card. It's never enough. If somehow I believe something outside of me is what I'm dependent upon to be whole as a whole human being. And how many times have we left ourselves looking for this approval, this love, this validation to be seen? It's, I know it for myself, it's so painful. So again, this old country western song, I'm looking for love in all the wrong places. I forgot to look inside me. But you know, many of us, due to our upbringing and conditioning, we have been maybe led to believe that we are not lovable, that we're not worthy, you're not smart, not athletic, you won't succeed in business, you damaged goods. A friend of mine, he was tall and kind of clumsy growing up, and his mother had taken her life. The father was a retired military commander, and with three sons that were big in a small apartment, and it was a rough situation. And the father used to call my friend, you've heard of the children's poem story, King Midas, everything you touch turns to gold. He was told, King Minos, your name is King Minos, and everything you touch breaks. Yeah, that's powerful. Fortunately, there's a good story to this beautiful man that found his heart and not only was successful in the world, but in his heart. But these upbringings, these conditionings are very strong. And there's reasons why we look outside for approval and validation to be someone's because of our own deep, profound insecurities, because we never learn that. But the thing is, we didn't come in this way. I've been blessed with a grandson who's a little bit over two now. But particularly when he was younger, I mean, he's being conditioned. It's happening. And how do we shape this conditioning in a way that can support someone to become confident and flexible rather than feeling that they're damaged goods and they won't amount to anything? It's so important. Like our upbringing as parents, supporting our children to help them to feel more confident and flexible and to not take away their sovereignty. Being shamed, being humiliated, makes you begin to feel small. But we didn't come in this way. And I love like being around a little kid. Like if my grandson was here right now and he had to have a bowel movement in front of you, he wouldn't care less. Or he'd pee, or he'd throw up, he'd laugh, he'd cry. He hasn't yet learned about shame and humiliation. Like we all came in this way. And what happened? Even all the prejudice in the world, skin color. I mean, we can just go on and sexual identification and gender identity and everything. This was all learned. We weren't anything like that. This was learned. And I think the power of the Dharma teachings is whatever is learned, if we become aware of what it is that we learned, we can potentially begin to unlearn it. That's a huge possibility. Because, you know, the Arab kids didn't come in hating Jews. The Jews didn't come in hating the Arabs. The white people didn't come in hating the blacks. The blacks didn't come in hating the whites. Like, this is all learned. So powerful if we can begin to become aware of what we have learned. But we sometimes get so stuck. You know, growing up, there was Popeye the Sailor Man, and he used to have this song, I am what I am, because that's the way I am, I'm Popeye the Sailor Man. And you know, as long as you keep on holding to that, you don't see anything else. It just goes on and on, self-referencing, self-referencing, self-referencing. But what happens if we begin to develop awareness? The difference between self-reference to self-awareness. Oh, here's a story that I've identified with, this belief, this conditioning. Oh, maybe that's not all of me. Maybe I'm not King Minos after all. Our conditioning is very powerful. So I sometimes, there's a story when the Buddha was awakened, he put his begging bowl in the stream. And, you know, normally streams go downstream. Well, the bowl went upstream. And that was like the symbol of liberation, breaking the stream of becoming, breaking the streaming of conditioning. When the Buddha awakened, he said he experienced the unconditioned. You can only know the unconditioned because there's a condition. Seeing through the conditioning, the stories, the narratives, the beliefs, the identifications. This is the potential liberating qualities of the Dharma. So this craving to be something, someone, bringing our awareness, where is happiness to be found? You know, our world will have us believe that how much money we have, what type of house we have, what type of all these things that we have, that is kind of a definition of successful. This is why the Buddha was such a radical revolutionary in India at that time, breaking the caste system with the teachings that you're not noble because you were born in a Brahma class. You're noble because of the purification of your mind and heart, the lessening of greed, hatred, and ignorance, the increasing of contentment, love, and clarity, wisdom. So this last craving is the craving to feel nothing. And I touched upon this a little earlier as well. It's kind of a like the sense of losing ourselves into, it's like thanatos, annihilation, the death instinct to numb, to disassociate, to discount, to lose ourselves into drugs, alcohol, you know, lose ourselves into puzzles. I mean, we could lose ourselves in a thousand different ways so we don't have to be here. That also can be kind of addictive. Not being here, just kind of numb, kind of foggy. And I can understand sometimes that it can be very alert for that. And I remember one time, fortunately my son is fine, but there was a period of time where it was possible he had a cancer. It turned out that it didn't. But I remember during that time, it was so much for me. I just wanted to sleep. I just didn't want to be here. I remember preparing for a Dharma talk, and I was like the craving to feel nothing. And I felt like I didn't really quite relate to that. Then I was like, oh yeah, I relate to it. Then I began to see all these different aspects of my life of where I just want to go numb. I just don't want to feel it. I just want to push it away, this craving to feel nothing. I think it's powerful that nearly 2,600 years ago, this awakening Buddha saw insight into this human condition. It's like that's a Dharma jewel to me. That's still so pertinent now. It's amazing. It's a lot in this human condition. You know, we came in, I mean, we were conceived and we were inside our mama's womb and we were connected via the placenta, and you know, then we get too big, we got to get out of there one way or another. And that cord is cut. It's a huge moment. Here we are in this life. The Buddha, as he was dying, says, spoken about the importance of having compassion for all beings, but also in his very last words, that all component things, all things are impermanent. Be a light unto yourself and strive on with heedfulness, with diligence. These are the last words. And I love that there's an invitation for each and every one of us to see with our own practice, to see for ourselves with our own experience. The Buddha called it ahipasiko, to see for yourself with your own experience. And don't believe the teacher because the teacher says so. Don't leave by hearsay. Don't leave by books. See for yourself with your own experience. This practice is supporting our own authority, inner sovereignty, and self-reliance, to see for ourselves with our own experience. What's true, what's not true. I love this other jewel of the Dharma. Based on one's own investigation. And I also want to say that in that very same sutta that the Buddha talks about, to see for yourself with your own experience, it's called the Kalama Sutta, that he also offers a criterion to know what is beneficial, because it was also within the sutta, it spoke that there was a lay person speaking to the Buddha. There's so many different paths in this world to follow, spiritual paths, and how do you know which one to go on? And I love how the Buddha answered this, and he didn't say my path. I love the humility, number one. But number two, so wise what he said. He said, any path, the criterion to know what a good path is, any path that is pointing towards the lessening of greed and hatred and ignorance. I think that's if there's a boat and we have a little rudder, like can we hold that rudder that directs us in the direction of lessening greed, lessening hatred, lessening ignorance? Or if we look at it in a more positive light, the path that's cultivating contentment. I'll tell you that you speak about pleasure. There is no greater pleasure in this world. And it's absolutely free. It doesn't cost you a cent. It's called contentment. Nothing is more wealthy than contentment. The opposite of hatred is love with the open heart. The opposite of ignorance is clear seeing into the nature of things, clear seeing the places where we get caught, where we're grasping onto, where we're holding, pushing away. So we'll just end with a very short little meditation now. This is from my teacher, Tumpulu. I'm going to say his whole name, Tumpulu Toya Kabaye Seropia, which means the teacher from the forest at Ghost Mountain. And he had this beautiful little pithy. This was actually the last set of teachings that he taught us at the monastery. He died not so long after. We worked with this for 3 months. And it's combined with your breath. And it's just this very simple meditation. He said this is a good meditation to die with. And it's also a good meditation to have an experience of what it's like to be free, to be awake. You could say it's an hors d'oeuvre of enlightenment. And I'm saying that. He didn't say that. But it is. So as you breathe in and breathe out, just for these breaths, as you breathe in and breathe out, feeling what it feels like, that any types of cravings, wantings, is just beginning to dissolve. And in its place, gives rise to contentment. Just to experience that, if it's possible, inviting it in with each breath in and out, dissolving of craving, being replaced with contentment, just as it is. And continuing, of course, with the breathing in and breathing out, and also experiencing this moment, the dissolving of hatred or aversion, ill will, in its place, loving kindness, the heart, compassion, appreciation, these qualities of the heart, dissolving of hatred or closeness, the openness of the open heart, breathing it in and breathing it out, this invitation. And with the breath in and the breath out, letting now this sense of ignorance or unawareness or not seeing clearly into things dissolve as you begin to see more clearly that, yes, this source of suffering is my grasping, my aversion, my misconception, beginning to reside with greater clarity, understanding, wisdom. This is the awakened heart, with contentment, with love, with clarity, dissolving of greed and hatred and ignorance into contentment, the vastness of the heart with love, the clear understanding, wisdom of suffering, its causes, and the path to freedom. May all beings discover the gateways into their hearts and grow with greater wisdom and compassion.